Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. I am broadcasting from a hotel room in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. We almost didn't make it in. It's snowing. Fuck, I'd forgotten, you know, not so much, but you get into to April. And you kind of think like, well, all right, well, it'll be nice in spring, look at the lake, walk around the Capitol, but it's just windy and fucking wet and snowy. It looks like it's breaking a little bit. If you hear some wind, it's outside of my window. But, you know, I guess I'm evolving around losing my mind because of things out of my control, because of the force majeure idea of what can and can't be done, and also weighing what is the worst that can really happen here. You know, what's at stake, really? But looking back on my life, I wonder, I've got to do a Google search. I should have done it before I got on the podcast, about the effect of panic and anxiety over the long term on the vessel we reside in, that our skin bag. You know what I'm saying? I'm not sure I want to look at that, because I'm looking back at my life and it's fucking crazy the amount of cortisol I've jammed through my system. Anyway, maybe I'll talk more about that. I don't know. It's sort of on my mind lately. But today on the show, I talked to Dina Hashem. She's a comic. She's a writer. She opened for me a few times. She was with me at the Beacon Theater in New York. I think she was with me out here once at Comedy on State. She recently released her first stand-up hour on Prime Video. It's called Dark Little Whispers. It was an interesting conversation. I didn't know what to expect because she's kind of she's got a quiet style. So I didn't know how it would go in regular conversation, but it was pretty great. So that's coming down the chute here in a few minutes. But let's discuss this, because I don't know, man. I think I've had it for a long time, this panic problem. But I don't know if it's panic. I don't know the difference between panic and anxiety. Is there a difference between panic and anxiety? I don't know. I just seem to be overwhelmed very quickly. And because there's some things going on in my career that are big things. And, you know, when I got the opportunity, my first reaction was like, no, I've got to, what am I going to do with the cats, and how am I going to, how am I going to live my life? Look, I've got a lot of things going on. I wake up, I go to the gym, I have coffee, and then I hang around, I do things around the house. And then, I interview people, and then, I have a pattern. I have a routine. Yeah. It's hard enough for me to just, get my brain together to get out there on the road. So everything comes at this intensity, anything. And there's a lot of things I've just learned that I have to do, and there's the jobs that I do, and I do them, and some of them have gotten easier, but there's still this sort of undercurrent of like, oh, fuck. When is that? How much time do I have before it happens? Oh my God. Just like crazy. And that can go on for months. It's an internal dialogue. I'm not really, sharing that with anybody. I guess that's a shift from when I was younger and in relationships that I've had in my life. Because, you know, if you have someone in your life and you're a nut job in terms of anxiety and panic, and if someone's there, you're going to bring them into it. Come on in. Welcome to the ride. I hope it's not too crazy for you. But I lose my mind sometimes for days, weeks, hours, and I just want you to be part of that. It's exhausting, and it's really not your job, but hey, we're together. Let's ride it out. And then once you get through it, you being me, and you're on the other side of it, it's like it's never happened, and then you're just sitting with an exhausted person who's saying, like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And that's where you learn boundaries, you know, in a relationship. It's been a long haul, and mostly it's an internal dialogue unless it really overflows into my life. And I think I've been like this so long, and I'm trying to track it. You know, I talked to Brendan about it, and, you know, some of it has to do with this, you know, vague future. I guess we all have a vague future. None of us really know what's going to happen to us in our lives, you know, in the world, but you can put parameters on it. You can make goals, and you can say, I'm doing this then and this then and this then, and this is how this is going to happen, and I've set it up. But even if all that's in place for me, it's really like, what am I doing tomorrow? I'm flying to Texas? How did I not know that? It's been on your schedule for months. I'm like, oh my God. And I don't know what that is about me. I don't think it's irresponsible. It's just, you know, I'm overwhelmed all the fucking time. And I imagine this is a normal thing. But the idea that if I had some real sense of what I wanted to do down the line would maybe kind of buffer the anxiety of anything that's happened in the present. I guess as maybe a, like, well, eventually I'm going to do this, or eventually I'll be here. And it's relatively set in stone, you know, with exceptions around, you know, health or something amazing happening or something horrible happening. And I think people with families and you know, plans for retirement or even vacations, you know, probably it tempers that overwhelming feeling of anxiety with everything. And look, I'm telling you right now, once I get to where I'm going or I'm doing what it is I've been dreading, I'm good. I'm fine. You know, I'm in it and I enjoy it. There's something about, you know, being panicked all the time that keeps you in the present in a way, even though you're reacting to things that aren't happening. But I don't know. Once I'm there, I'm good. And then all of that for naught, I guess. Or maybe it's just my preparation. I don't know. It's not intentional preparation, but it is how I've been doing it for a long time. But I do know now, as I get older, that it's a bit exhausting and I'm fucking tired of it. But it's always there. Even, like, I used to be terrified to fly. I mean, fucking terrified. To the point where before a flight, I would stay up all night, or I'd get drunk as shit, or I'd take drugs, you know, anything to get through the flight. No matter what I did, I wouldn't sleep on the plane because of the panic and the fear. And I don't know how that went away. I mean, I think part of it was just that, like, look, you know, it was almost a spiritual lesson. Where you once, you know, once that plane takes off, or even once the door closes, unless you're a lunatic, it's out of your control. There's nothing you can do. You can't fly the plane. There's nothing you can do. And I think I've kind of that's kind of wired into me now. But when I'm on a plane and we take off, you know, I'm definitely not comfortable, and I'm thinking about, like, what are the thoughts that come in? Oh, hitting another plane is one. The moment of realizing you're going down is another. The sort of, you know, processing and accepting that it's a pretty unlucky way to die, but I guess this is the way it is. And just picturing terror on all, this happens with everything to one degree or another. What is the horrible thing that's going to happen, and live in it? And I don't know what that's about. I guess it's more defined than, hey man, everything's pretty good and I'm having a nice flight, or I'm having a nice life. You know, that seems more challenging because I don't have an immediate way to process that as something I think about or live in. But just sort of like, we're all going to fucking die is, well, that's pretty, you know, straight up. It's conclusive. You know, it's concrete. We're all going to fucking die in my head. Imagine me through all those years starting to do comedy. Just the anxiety and the terror of going on stage just to do 5 minutes when I was starting out would go on for weeks. All that fucking cortisol and insanity, you know, just like fuck. And I bring it for 5 minutes. So I guess I must be an addict of, I'm addicted to panic and whatever happens in my brain chemically from that panic. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But the memory that I sort of locked into when I was thinking about this stuff, sitting here in my hotel room in Wisconsin, I just went to the gym down there, is that when I was a kid, I would say maybe 9 or 10. Let's go with 9 or 10. And I remember there was one time that my parents went on a trip to Hawaii, and the woman that used to clean the house, this old woman, Carmen, she was house sitting. She was babysitting my brother and I. And my parents left emergency numbers, you know, in Hawaii or where, one time. I remember that because as soon as they left, I couldn't get out of my head the idea that their plane crashed in the ocean. And it was just devastating. It was debilitating just thinking about them crashing into the ocean, the plane at the bottom of the ocean. And I could not get it out of my head. And the anxiety and the panic and the fear, the crying, the insanity that went on for days, even after the plane landed, because they had to come back, to the point where I got sick. I vomited. I couldn't go to school. I was, you know, paralyzed with panic. Had to call the emergency number and make sure they were okay. And it was crazy that, and at 10, I don't know if that's unusual or whether or not I should have had more separation from them, but it was also just about knowing they were around. It wasn't like they were that attentive. You know, my dad was hardly ever home and my mom was, you know, in her own world, you know, in a way, but they were around. And I realized that's exactly the same thing now. It's like, it's my cats, it's my house, it's my car, it's my dumb, you know, routine, it's my cooking. It's around. They're around, and there's a consistency to it. And once I shift out of that, you know, until I ground myself in whatever I'm doing, I'm fucking nuts. And again, I stifle it. I keep it to myself and I manage it. I self-parent around that stuff and realize that, you know, I have years and years of experience in doing this stuff. There's plenty of precedent set for me surviving, but the anxiety is real. And some of it has gotten a little worse lately. Tonight, I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom. Tomorrow, I'm in Chicago at the Vic Theater, Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater this Saturday, April 6th, Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival, Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center, Glenside, Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater. And someone told me it's not Keswick. Is that right? One person said it's Keswick because it's British, and that still doesn't make sense. Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. Munhall, Pennsylvania, outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall. Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at the Playhouse Square. Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my dates and links to tickets. Folks, listen, I'm not great at decisions, clearly. Sometimes there are too many choices and I get overwhelmed. Other times I have a hard time picking between two things. But every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. So I flew out of Chicago to come here to Madison, Wisconsin. Now, I don't know why. You know, I was going to rent a car here in Madison and drive to the other gigs with my opener, Ali Makovsky. And I was, for some reason, we were booked to fly from Chicago to Madison once we landed in Chicago. Now, sometimes, most of the time, technology is kind of fucking amazing when I really think about it. Because, well, I don't need to think about it that much. Look, I'm on a microphone in a fucking hotel room, and you're going to hear this tomorrow. I mean, it's fucking nuts. But just relative to panic and to the past and to being old enough to remember life without certain things. Like, I was on the plane. I was online on the plane. I got a text from American Airlines that the flight from Chicago to Madison had been canceled because of weather. And then from there, we were able to see if there was another flight. There was only a full flight. And then from there, and this is in the air, I was like, I'll just rent a fucking car in Chicago. I don't even know why we're flying to Madison anyways. How bad could the weather be? Let's just get a small SUV and fucking do it. You know, and we're landing at like 7. It's not going to be like the middle of the night. So I was able to secure a car at Hertz on the plane. And I know this just seems like practical stuff, or if you're, you know, working on the road. But back in the day, holy fuck, man. I mean, think about it. We would have landed in Chicago. We would have gone to the board. It would have said that flight was canceled. We would have been like, fuck, what the fuck are we going to do? And then we would have scrambled to see at the American desk, when's the next flight? Probably not till tomorrow. Oh, it looks like there's a United flight. We would have, you know, fucking run over to the United terminal to see if we could get on that flight. And then it was sold out. We found that out online. And so we would have been like, well, fuck, I guess we got to get a hotel or just try to rent a car. But this whole process would have taken hours. And the stress of it, if you're someone like me, would have been a fucking nightmare. There would have been running in the airport. Running in the airport is not someplace that I want to be. But, you know, we just fucking worked it out. And we got the car. We ended up eating. It's so weird. There's actually a restaurant at the Chicago, at O'Hare, in the American terminal that I look forward to eating at. Is that bizarre? Because Allie was texting me on the plane, like, can we drive into Chicago and get some dinner? And I'm like, that's 45 minutes the other direction from the airport. And I was like, but you know what? There's a great restaurant at O'Hare. You know, it's that, what's that guy's name? Is it Rick Bayless? Is that, he's got a Mexican sandwich shop called Torta over in terminal, I don't know what terminal it was, but it was American. It was literally right outside the gate that we walked out of. So because we were able to set everything up, you know, on the plane and get our fucking ducks in a row with the car, we, you know, I told Hertz we'd pick it up at 7. And it was like we actually had a leisurely dinner, and it was very good. These sandwiches, I might have eaten a little cheese. I think I picked most of it off. I fucked up, but I got the vegetarian sandwich. Don't tell anybody. It's not the same. It's not drugs. Because Allie said, is this a cheese lapse? I'm like, no, it's not. I'll be all right. I'll live. It's not like I'm going to, you know, eat a piece of cheese by accident or have something with some egg in it. And then the next day just be, you know, sitting in my hotel room with a full barbecued pork ass, just sitting there with, you know, an entire rotisserie chicken, you know, in my underwear covered in grease, just like eating it. I'm like, I don't know what happened, man. I had one piece of cheese and this is where I'm at. I don't think I can get back, man. Where's the ham? I don't think that's going to be what happens. But anyways, the point is that we actually had dinner on purpose at an airport, and we didn't even have to. We could, you know, usually you're at airport, like, let's get going. Let's get out. Let's get on the next plane. It's a transitional space. But I'm like, no, this is a good sandwich, and we got to drive for a couple hours. Let's sit down and eat at O'Hare. And here I am. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp, which I need, actually, it seems. Have you ever heard of a social battery? Basically, how charged are you when it comes to having social interaction? Some people have an easily rechargeable social battery. For lots of us, we can feel drained or empty a lot, especially when social gatherings pick up. How do you recharge? How do you get the most of your social battery's capacity?
Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, and it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I know this may shock you, but I'm not the most comfortable in large social settings, but that doesn't mean I can't go to a party or have a conversation with someone as long as I'm feeling okay in my head. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/WTF today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/WTF. All right? Okay. So look, you guys, Dina Hashem, very funny, very smart, comedian, writer. I didn't know what to expect, and I'd hung out with her before because she opened for me, but this was a great conversation. It was very very charming, very funny, very smart. I enjoyed it. And you can watch her stand-up special, Dark Little Whispers, on Prime Video. Here we go.
Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcast.
What's happening? Do you come out here often?
No, almost never.
How's it feel for you?
Actually, I really love it because of one reason in particular.
The English muffin place?
No, it's even better than that.
No,
it's the Round One Arcade at Burbank Mall.
Come on.
Listen, I could talk about it for...
Wait, the Round One Arcade, like it's an old-timey arcade with the...
No, it's like an update. It's like, okay, so Round One is a chain of arcades around
okay.
the country.
There's
not enough. There's only like, I don't know, maybe 30 locations
right.
across the country. There's not one in New York, which is very important, which is
yeah.
why I'm excited to be here. And what's special about it is it has this game called Gita Jora.
Yeah.
Which is a drumming rhythm game. And it's like Guitar Hero, but it's for the drums. And it has a full Yamaha electronic drum kit.
Okay.
So if you play this game for 1,000 hours like I have, it teaches you how to play the drums.
Is that where you learn to play drums?
Yeah.
Stop it.
I swear.
On that game?
Yes. And anyone can learn if you just go to the Burbank Mall and you spend lots and lots of money.
Well, how do you stand in technique against other drummers in general? In conversation, perhaps?
Well, of course, my technique is not good, but I actually just took my first real drum lesson, and he was like, just play around, let me watch you, and I'll tell you what you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
So I played for a little bit, and he's like, yeah, you know what you're doing. And so I stopped the lessons, because he's like, if you want to get better, you just need to practice on your own. Like, obviously, I'm not, like, amazing. And
no, I know. But I watched at the end of the special, you just kind of kick out the drums. I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
And it's like what you do.
The most fun part about doing the special was recording that song.
I could tell.
Really? yeah. I think it's obvious.
Well, no, it's a funny kind of juxtaposition. I mean, we worked together. When was that? At the Beacon?
At the Beacon
and then in Madison?
In Madison, exactly, yeah.
I can't remember. Were you in Madison or did you come out to do that?
No, I came.
And we hung out. That was fun, but and the Beacon was fun, but
yeah.
I'm watching you on the special, and you know I know your style, but then you're playing drums at the end, and I'm like, oh, she's holding in a lot.
Yeah.
Where's all that?
I know. And I'm like, well, the special also, it hurts because I watch myself and I'm like, that's not even me. Like, I really do. I learned how to have fun on stage recently, very recently.
After the special?
Yeah. very, very recently. And it's not there. It's not in the special because I was nervous, of course. It's my first special.
Yeah.
I was nervous. I had two shows. And like, so I watch it and I'm like, that's not even what I do on stage anymore.
So it shifted in since when? When did you record that special?
I mean, no, my energy shifted, I would say, like a few years ago. So it was, it should have been captured in the special, but I was nervous. I was nervous. And I'm not saying like I'm like now like an act out crazy comedian. It's just that I care so much less about stand-up than I used to. And so,
so it's the zero fucks thing.
Yeah, there's still some fucks. I'm trying to get to zero, but yeah. I've like the fuck level has dropped significantly.
Because you're great and the jokes are great, and I remember working with you, but I know you were nervous. But it's interesting because I actually talked to my producer. I'm like, I don't know if this is totally a choice. You know, the way that she's doing her performance. And it kind of wasn't.
You're right. You're right. It's not.
But it's a good special. I don't want to diminish the special. But I remember working with you. And I could just because I'm a comic, I'm sensitive to the nervousness part. But you're also, like, you're not like, you were never like, hey, how's everybody doing? You know what I mean? But you are on drums. You're definitely a, hey, how's everybody doing drummer.
I hope so.
And then you kind of rock hard.
Yeah. Like, I
all metal all the time?
Well, I have, I'm actually so obsessed with drums that I'm in a comedy band now, and I never thought I would delve into musical comedy. Yeah. I know, but
is it with other comedians?
Yes, very funny comedians. Very funny.
So these are not unlike many comedians, the musician dreamers.
I would say.
Yeah, who, like, because I play, obviously, but I was never going to pursue that.
Music?
Yeah. I never did, and it took me years to play in public. I had a band rehearsal yesterday, but we're not like always practicing. But we do Largo gigs where we'll do like six or seven covers.
Yeah,
and just as a band. But it took me 50 some odd years to find the courage to do that. And I'm not a bad player.
So is it because you just have no interest, or
no? It's just like I used to do a joke about how like I play guitar, but I never set out to play it professionally. So my guitar is not like a vessel of broken dreams. Like I wanted it to keep it, I didn't want the pressure because I know myself. It's like once, even with a band, there's so many other things to worry about. You don't want to fuck up the song. You don't want to, the word, whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess I used to be nervous like that when I was doing stand-up originally, but I didn't want to ruin guitar.
That's so smart to keep something you enjoy as a non-professional activity.
I mean, it's like one of my few things where I've gone through periods where I'm like, I'm sure you have with the drums, where you're like, I want to get better. I want to learn some new things.
Right.
And I do it,
right.
And I'm kind of happy that I did it. But anytime I see anybody else play guitar, like 12-year-olds on fucking Instagram, I'm like, I'm not in the game.
I know. It's the same with, I picked up skateboarding recently and I'm like,
How old are you?
Oh, God. 34.
Come on.
I identify as a teenage boy, though. That's all my hobbies are. But
that just becomes a thing about, like, if you're nervous on a skateboard, you're going to fucking hurt yourself.
I know. And that's why I reached the wall where I'm like, if I'm going to really try to get good at this, I have to risk injury. And I don't think
Were you at the edge of a pool?
I actually can drop in. Not on extreme heights, but I can drop in.
Really?
It's actually not the scariest part of skateboarding.
Do you wear a helmet?
No.
Pads? Knee pads?
I do. I started wearing pads after I took a really brutal fall on my knee.
What's it going to take to wear a helmet?
I fell on my head once already, actually.
Yeah. How was that for you?
It was all right. I handled it.
You're not wearing a helmet because you don't think it's cool. Because you're standing there beside the pool with nine teenage boys.
Oh my God. During the pandemic, I was showing up to my high school, my high school, and I was in the tennis courts ollie with literally a 13-year-old boy. I'm like, oh, I look like a pedophile. People must be like, there's no way this woman is trying to actually learn how to skate.
Yeah. I bought a board once, like down in, when I lived in the Lower East Side, there was, this board shop when they were doing those big boards and they were kind of around. And I just decided that's maybe what my persona should be. So like, I went and bought a board and I went out to where they were skating around it used to be a basketball court or something. There was a flat and there were all these other guys kind of doing the things. And I just sat there on my board and they're looking at me. I'm like, I can't do it.
Yeah. But
I got a good board.
So you just stopped?
I didn't really even start. I bought the board and that was the end of the fantasy.
Well, that's okay. You do a lot of cool things. And
I know. Some things don't stick. What are you going to do?
It's just the hardest thing to really, really get good at.
So everyone's a comic. How are you guys, how are you doing? How are you playing in terms of the band?
Oh, we haven't had any. This is very recent.
So you're just kind of fucking around?
No, like, well, it's so it's Kyle Dunnigan is like, it's his band. I should say that.
I know him. He's in New York again?
Yeah, he moved.
He did?
Yeah.
During the pandemic?
No, actually, I don't know. Maybe like a year ago? I think it's pretty recent.
Wow. No kidding. I miss seeing him around. He's a funny guy.
He's the best.
What does he play?
Everything. He plays keyboard. He plays guitar. He sings. He's so good at writing music.
Yeah. He's a talented fella.
So talented.
Yeah. So it's him and who else?
Me, David Angelo, another very funny comedian. Yeah. Caroline Banowitz.
Yeah.
And Tony, which is not a comedian, just one of Kyle's friends, who's a really good guitarist.
Just Tony. Tony's on the guitar.
Yeah, Tony on the strings.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, I don't play with comics anymore. I didn't do it that much. I play with like real musicians. And it's kind of interesting because like I'm freaking out and to them it's just sort of like, no problem.
Right.
It's inspiring. Like they don't care. They've been doing it their whole life. So it's second nature for them. It's not whether they're all good. But like when I'm out of practice, I'm like, oh my God, pressure's on. Here we go. And these guys are just loose.
Do you feel the pressure because you want them to like?
I don't think even though I've gone out and done it and sang and stuff and I can, and I know I'm okay. I still get very, I'm insecure about it, that's all.
Oh, in front of an audience, you mean?
In front of an audience okay, and sometimes in front of these guys because I got this guitar player now that never stops playing. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, he's all over the frets and I'm like, all right.
Did you teach yourself?
Not really. I took some lessons I guess I was in high school.
Okay.
Like I learned the basics that have gotten me this far. And then Jimmy Vivino, the guy from the old Conan show, the band leader, his old band leader became sort of a friend and he would show me licks every time I'd do Conan. And then eventually I kept getting better and I eventually played with him. He was in my band briefly.
That's amazing.
That was a big deal.
That's so cool.
But I still don't believe I'm good enough.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe that's with everything.
No. I had the same moment where so I played the drums with Yola Tango and it was just like the coolest thing that's ever happened.
That's a good pace. You know, you don't have to show off too much with Yola Tango. You know what I mean? They're not going to be, you know, there's no metal requirements.
Yeah. It was the perfect starting place for someone who learned an arcade game.
That's a good breaking in point to play with them.
But it was a thing of like, wow, could I possibly be good enough to actually be a drummer in a band? But
yeah.
It's like, probably. I mean, it would
You definitely could. You know who used to be a drummer?
Who?
Todd Barry.
Oh, I know.
You know that.
Yeah, Todd played with them too. Same shows. Yeah.
Oh, really? He did too? How'd he do?
Oh, I wasn't there. I saw some video, but I think he's... Yeah, I don't know if I'm better than Todd. I have to find that out.
I think you're probably better. I mean, I remember playing with Todd at some point in my life. You know, the weird thing is like you've got to sort of stay with it,
right.
You know, any of it, to kind of stay in the groove of it. Same with stand-up. Like, I'm crazy like that from New York, the training. Like, I have to get on stage at least twice a week. If I go like 2 weeks without stand-up, I'm like, I don't know how to do
same.
It.
Same.
I forgot how to do it.
But you still feel that way? Really?
I do. It's 60. It's fucking stupid.
What's the longest you've taken off in like recent years?
The pandemic.
Oh, right.
The entire pandemic. Right. And you know what? Felt great.
Really? You loved it?
Loved it. I was like, maybe I'm all better. Maybe I... But like, and I thought like, you know, I could live without it. But as soon as people started doing it, I'm like, fuck, here we go again.
That's interesting that you thought for a moment you could be done though.
I did.
What?
I think that about everything, but I think it's just someplace my brain goes so I don't have anxiety.
Okay.
Like, I think there's a part of my brain that's sort of like, I'm just going to stop and go. But it always involves traveling and disappearing entirely.
Yeah.
It's not just sort of like, I'm going to stop and sit in this house. It's like, I'm going to stop. I'm going to go to New Mexico. I'm not going to have a phone. Like that kind of shit.
Okay.
It's a little bit much, but it makes me feel relaxed.
Yeah. I mean, the pandemic was also part of, I think it was the inciting incident for me giving less fucks about stand-up. So
really?
It really helped a lot.
Did you do any of that ridiculous stuff?
I did Zoom shows? I did like a couple of Zoom shows.
I couldn't do any of it. The outdoor shows, none of it.
Really?
I didn't do any of it.
Just because you're like, this is bullshit or...
Well, they were doing these gigs where, like, you know, in drive-in theaters or, like, weird fucking places. I'm like, I had to do those when I was coming up, and they were awful.
Yeah.
You know, just because the situation calls for it doesn't mean it's not going to suck. So I'd rather live without it.
It did sort of feel like that in a way. It felt like starting again with these really shitty shows.
Yeah.
But I had fun, actually. Maybe not. There was like one Instagram live show. I was like, I'll never do that again because you really can't hear anyone laugh and it's absurd. But I was doing like shows, outdoor shows in Connecticut with Sam Morrell. And like, there was like literally a truck going by every other joke. It was just kind of like funny.
I guess so. Yeah. I guess like I just didn't, I don't know. I didn't, I was already in the pandemic. I had enough problems the way it was. I didn't need to go on stage and feel shitty about comedy, because I know I would, even if it was a compromised situation, I'd still judge myself as if it were normal.
All right,
so what changed though? What changed in your performance that made you, why are you a new person now?
Not a lot. I mean, people maybe not even notice the difference. Some people have said they've noticed, but like I used to just really be like, I treated stand-up like school, and I was always a great student. I was like, I have to be really good at this. I have to do it properly. Yeah. I have to write great jokes. And then I was like, oh, I'm a clown. It just kind of hit me. Like, oh, this is stupid. What I do is stupid. Like, I should treat it as such. And and so it allowed me to just take it less seriously. Yeah. And that let me, losing respect for stand-up, I think, helped me be better at it.
That's interesting. I mean, because, like, I don't know. I guess you're... Like, you come from a pretty strict joke writing tradition.
Yeah. Oh, God, it sounds so pretentious. Yeah. What?
No, I mean, we make choices. I mean, like, how long have you been doing it?
Since I started 2010, 2011.
Oh, well, that's not bad.
It's a long time.
But let's go back, because, I mean, you talk in the special about, like, because I don't get to talk to a ton of Muslims. And I guess we've been a little Jew heavy lately, so we got to head out.
I'm happy to help.
And it's not even because comedy is Jewish anymore. It used to be, but it's really not. It's gotten pretty inclusive, and everyone sort of finds their way. But I think in the 70s, it was just like, oh, another Jew.
Right.
But not anymore.
Right. Now it's everyone. Now it's like 16-year-olds mostly.
I can't even deal with that. It's not even on my radar. I'm missing everything. But I'm not sure I'm missing anything.
You don't look at TikTok or Instagram or...
Not for comedy. Like, I see the crowd work trend, you know, but I don't know who the influencers are. And I don't know who the TikTok comedians are by name. I don't know what they're doing out there. I know they can sell tickets. I've never really watched, Matt Rife do anything. Mm-hmm. I've watched maybe 3 minutes of Andrew Schultz, and I know they now have their own armies,
empires,
apparently.
Yeah.
That's another way to say it. I'm more concerned about the army element. I'm a little concerned about the tribalization of the medium.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It's just all these people running around saying, like, I don't want to get canceled. And it's like, we don't even know who you are.
Right.
So clearly that's your hook. Maybe write some jokes.
Totally. Tell it. Preach. Drag them, Mark.
I drag them. It's not even subtle. And when I do, like, the great thing about my audience and who I go out to is that I'm insulated enough that not one of those fuckers will hear it unless I put it on in TikTok. And then I get into some problems. Had some problems on TikTok.
Oh, yeah?
Minor problems. I don't like getting involved with it, but I have an inability to compartmentalize.
Right. I mean, I've leaned into comedy drama just once recently, and I usually never do. I never talk publicly.
Not the tweet that got you fucked up?
Oh, it's related to that.
Oh.
So, I mean, obviously, I don't care about Matt Rife discourse. I don't care about him. It doesn't bother me just because, like I said, I've lost respect for this art form. So I don't care who succeeds at it.
Well, that's good because he's not really doing it.
Right. Well, yes, that as well. That as well, for sure.
He's doing something. But the fucked up thing about crowd work is like for me, crowd work was a skill you should have.
Yeah.
Not something you should do.
It's like break in case of emergency.
That's right.
Yeah.
You want to be able to handle yourself in any situation up there. And there's been plenty of good crowd work comedians, but it's not, the craft.
For sure. I mean, I honestly have changed my tune a little bit about crowd work in a shocking way where, I mean, I myself don't enjoy it. I don't go out to watch it. But I think stand-up in our culture, live performance, has given people a sense of community that is largely missing in their lives.
Yes.
So if comedy is somewhere they can go and, like, talk to another human being and hear other people's thoughts, then maybe that's a good thing.
No, I will do it, like, because you want to have that relationship with your audience to where it's conversational. But the idea of going from person to person and being like, so what's up?
For sure.
Yeah. You know, it's just, if you're quick, it's just cheating.
Yeah.
In a way. You know what I mean? Like, you can just do it.
Well, the bar is so much lower for the audience to be impressed by you. Because, like, I mean, you could say almost nothing and they'll laugh with crowd work.
Yeah.
Like, they just love it.
And sometimes it's like a good bit of crowd work. It's, you don't, that's the other reason you got to be careful if you have an act. Because if you do a little crowd work and it kills hard, you can't. They know that you're just doing a script.
I made that mistake. I went into crowd work because, like, I did the special. I was like, I don't want to do old stuff. So I was like, I'm going to do a lot of crowd work. But then there was, like, a big moment of laughs from crowd work. And then I went back into material. And they're like, fuck you. We don't give a shit about your Muslim trauma. Go back to talking to us.
That probably wasn't the exact tone. But there's no reason not to project that onto
your literally
audience.
Said that.
No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
Okay, well, let's go back and then we'll kind of move through the controversy. So, like, I'm trying to think who I talked to specifically about a Muslim childhood. And I'm finding it all very, there's things as an old white guy that I learn, particularly from, you know, TV shows of, like, Reservation Dogs and Rami's show. The engagement with a culture, you know, from a second generation point of view, or just from the point of view of the culture, like, there's no way for me to know things, you know, by reading about it or seeing a documentary or whatever. It's like, also Past Lives was another one. Did you watch Past Lives, the movie?
I still need to see that.
It's still all an education to me. And even though Muslim is not that different than Jew in a way.
Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Yeah. I mean, your last name could be Jewish.
It is, sort of. It means God. It means the name of God
right.
in Hebrew.
Hashem. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was it in your childhood that ruined it?
So just to be clear, the question is, how did Islam ruin my life?
Yeah.
Question? Okay. So clearly you didn't watch the special. Clearly you didn't watch the special.
I did watch. I watched all of it. But I want to get beyond the jokes. This is called Dina Hashem Beyond the Jokes. Behind the Jokes with Dina Hashem.
Okay.
Yeah. You grew up in Jersey.
I did.
And that's where you got the arcade problem, isn't it?
No, actually. Well, yeah. So DDR, do you know, are you familiar with DDR? Also known as Dance Dance Revolution.
Sure.
I did grow up addicted to that because it was not, it was.
So you can dance too?
Yeah, I can do the DDR dance. That's how I dance in real life for sure. Yeah.
Like you just hopped off the machine?
It is the only way I know how to dance. Yeah. I can't dance. But it was in this roller rink. Rollerblading was like a huge part of my life. Every weekend I'd go to the roller rink and they had this DDR machine.
Music, mirror ball.
Mirror ball?
A mirror ball.
Oh, yeah. Oh, is not a disco ball? I would call it a disco ball.
Okay, yeah, same thing.
Yeah. that's where, I grew up in Central Jersey.
Yeah. Which part of Jersey?
It's called Islin.
Not where Rami grew up? Not was there a big Muslim population?
I forget
population?
What town he grew up in.
A lot of Muslims
in
Jersey, right?
Yes, definitely. Well, the town I grew up in, Islin, it's also known as Little India. It's like the largest population of Indian immigrants, I think, in the country. And obviously, yes, there's a Muslim population within that. I forget where Rami grew up, but yeah, I mean.
Good food, right?
Indian food, yeah. Great food.
Oh, it's the best.
Great food.
See, that's where, that's where my knowledge of India drops off. If I don't talk to an Indian comedian, which I have a couple, and learn more things, but it was really about food for most of my life.
Yeah.
Just sort of like, man, you got that great bread.
That's most people's
I know, but I think that's wrong. Yeah. I think you should know more. So now teach me.
Okay, so beyond the falafel and the hummus, there's a lot of trauma.
Real trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
I'm mad now when people trivialize this new approach to psychotherapy, trauma-based approach, because I think it's very smart. And I've heard a comic recently kind of poo-poo it, and I'm like, go fuck yourself.
Wait, I don't even know what it is. It's a form
just the idea of, you know, attaching, you know, a certain amount of meaning. It's just really thinking about PTSD, I think, in a broad way. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we're going to be wired a certain way and it's going to affect us far beyond, you know, our childhood because of a repetition of patterns or something that, you know, really fucked with us. And I think to focus on that, like with EMDR or trauma processing, mm-hmm. is like, it's smart.
For people with actual trauma, of course.
Which is most people. I mean, some worse than others. I'm doing a bit about that right now.
Okay.
How you sort of like decide for yourself which traumas really defined you or fucked you up.
Right.
And it might be surprising.
Huh.
I can't go in the whole bit. I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So tell me the trauma.
God, where do I start? I don't know.
But were you religious? And was there a lot of people in the family?
Well,
two questions.
No, very small family, very like isolatingly small. So, yeah. Well, my mom and dad divorced when I was like six.
Right.
He moved to Kuwait, so he lived there my whole life.
Was it a planned marriage?
Planned marriage?
They
were married for a while because they had my brother already. He's 5 years old.
But like, was it like, did they want to marry each other? Where'd they get married?
You know, you're going to find out how little I know about my family because I hated them for so long.
All of them?
Yeah. Yeah. I believe they must have been married in Egypt.
Yeah.
My dad was Egyptian.
Because I know there's a thing where, like, if they come to America and they're married and there's an expectation about, honoring the religion or even an arranged marriage, sometimes that craps out.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't arranged.
That could be
wrong. But
yeah.
They were not married in America for sure.
Yeah. So he splits. How old are you?
Six.
So that's a lot right there.
Really? Is that a common thing?
Well, I mean, it's sort of abandonment.
I'd love a diagnosis at the end of this.
Yeah, okay, I could. Fortunately, I have a doctor who's also listening in.
That would be awesome. Wouldn't that be a great podcast? A doctor sits in at the end, they say what you
have. They got to have one. Yeah, but the person doesn't know it. But you wouldn't be able to keep that hidden. I could just pretend like I'm that good. Like he's texting. Yeah. He's texting me as I... As he's listening?
I wouldn't even be mad, but like, that's great. I've never gone to therapy, so it would...
You've never gone to therapy?
I went to one session my entire life.
And
one
were you
hour.
Traumatized by that?
Yeah. I cried the whole time.
That's what it is.
But I was like, if that's what it is, then I don't...
We were supposed to stop crying at some point.
Okay, I didn't stop the whole time,
it takes a few weeks, maybe months. Could be years. But yeah, the idea is to stop crying. And have self-acceptance and boundaries and stuff.
Well, I believe I'm sort of my own therapist.
Good for you. Yeah,
thank you.
It's all upstairs. All right, so what happened? So you got a brother?
Yeah.
And just the two of you?
Yes, and my mother and my stepdad, who she married. So she married my stepdad. It was a green card marriage, essentially, so that he could have a green card and so that she could keep custody of my brother and I, because I believe my dad wanted to take us to the Middle East with him. And my mom, she had like no money. I mean, he made the money. And
yeah.
From what I understand, I don't know remember the details, but like he fucked her over in some way where they had a house, but then because
your real dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she wanted a divorce. He was like, got the house.
Yeah.
I don't know the real estate word for it, but they lost money on it. And so she had nothing and she didn't even have money for like a lawyer. So like, she's like, the court is not going to give her the kids if she just can't prove she has like an apartment or like a way
right.
of supporting us. So she married my stepdad as a way of keeping us. And I'm very thankful for that. So I grew up with her and my stepdad.
Is he a Muslim guy?
Yeah. Another Egyptian.
Oh, okay.
Man,
yeah.
Who, I mean, people don't believe me when I say this, but I only realized it recently. We had a fight when I was, like, shortly after we started living together, when I was, like, 6 or 7.
Yeah.
We had a fight, and we never spoke again. I mean, I literally spent, like, 15 years of my life living with a man I never spoke to.
That's problematic.
Is that weird? That's not normal, right?
In the house.
Yeah, that's not normal.
So you had to maintain this vigilance. Like, you had to catch yourself sometimes?
No, it was not even like neither of us tried to talk to each other.
Wow.
Because the fight was...
At dinner?
We didn't sit down and eat dinner together.
And what was the fight?
So I didn't have my own room in this first apartment we had. My brother got the room to himself, and my parents had their room. So I got, like, a sectioned off part of the living room that was separated with, like, these dividers. So one day I came home from school and I found my stepdad snooping around my area. And I was very protective of it because it's all I have. And I just yelled at him. I was like, what are you doing? Get out of my area. And he was like, you can't talk to me like that. And he stormed off and we never spoke again.
To this day.
I mean, he would come home. I would say hi, Mo. He would say hi, Dina. And that was our lives.
Wow. To this day.
They divorced recently, but yeah.
Recently. Huh. Okay. So that's, well, at least you have commitment. You have stick-to-itness.
Who is at fault there? Should I have been the bigger person? Like, let's hash this out. I'm six, but let's talk.
No, clearly I don't know. That guy had the problem.
He must have had his own problems.
Yeah, right? He was. I don't know what it was. Maybe he was uncomfortable with you. Who the fuck knows? But yeah, it was sort of on him when you're six.
I would say, right?
To sort of navigate that.
That's what I thought.
As a parent, kind of.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my side.
And your mom said nothing?
Well, therein lies the trauma where my mom was like, she was not in her right mind my entire adolescence. As an adult, I learned to, in order to forgive her, I was like, she was dealing with all the fallout of my dad's shit. And like, she was probably like losing her mind my entire coming of age.
Right. And it's a marriage of convenience too, that she was trying to save her own life. Right.
Right. Yeah. And so like, once he got the green card, she thought they were going to split, but he was kind of like, actually, I like this. Let's stay together. But I mean, my entire childhood was them screaming at each other all night long, which part of the trauma of like almost every night they would be screaming. It was insane. Like,
it's horrendous.
As an adult, I'm like, I would never scream at my partner in front of my kids. Like, it doesn't add up, because that's why I tell myself like, oh, that's a sign of how much pain she was going through, because she's very loving and like she loves her kids. But like, the fact that she would do that in front of us was like, she must have been so out of her mind.
Yeah. Now you scream on the drums.
Exactly. Now it comes out on those fucking toms.
Because I can't, I'd like to see some screaming in the comedy if you.
Well, so, I mean, I would like to get there. And I have raised my voice on stage a little bit. It's part of the transformation.
That's good. I like it. I like it.
I'll get to the screaming, kinda, perhaps.
Maybe you could do it in a character.
Yeah, maybe.
Of your stepfather.
Well, I need to get my notebook. Yeah.
Okay, so that goes on for your entire fucking childhood?
Yeah.
Now, what's the Muslim component?
So that's the thing. It's like, sometimes I have trouble separating what was the Muslim trauma and what was just regular, like, shitty household trauma.
Well, I think just discussed the domestic trauma.
Yeah.
And so this guy was religious? Both of them were religious?
My mom definitely was. I mean, he was on paper, but I never saw him, like, pray.
Never?
No.
So he's a shitty Muslim and a monster.
Oh, God, it feels wrong to say that. I mean, I really think I have to attribute Muslim trauma.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. You can negotiate.
He was probably suffering his own Muslim trauma from growing up in a patriarchal Egyptian.
Very diplomatic. Very good for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, he was there. That's the thing.
But your mom did the praying in the...
Yeah, and I had to as well. She taught me how to pray. We was praying 5 times a day.
Mosque?
Well, no. Funny enough, my mom was so busy working and trying to, like, keep us alive that she didn't even have time to force us to go to mosque or even learn the language. This is something I actually am still mad at her for, where she didn't teach us Arabic because she was afraid that we would develop an accent. It's like, you couldn't have just asked somebody, asked a language expert, like, are they going to have an accent?
What did you pray? You didn't pray in Arabic?
Oh, yeah. So the only Arabic I know is prayers.
Oh, yeah. Jews do that, too.
Oh, right. But do you even know what you're saying? Like, I didn't even know what
I'm
saying.
No, I don't know what I'm
saying. Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah, but I'm not like a religious person. But you kind of go, you do what you got to do.
Right.
You know, you do the bar mitzvah and then you're out. And I can kind of make out some words if I look at Hebrew.
You don't have it memorized or anything?
No. I mean, yeah, the Hanukkah prayers. I'm not a good Jew when it comes to being religious, but I did do it. I learned how to read it and speak it. But I didn't know, no one ever taught us the language.
Isn't that funny? They didn't think it was important. It was more about just doing it than having you understand any part of it.
Like, yeah, I guess, I don't know. That's like another level. I mean, you know, Catholic Mass used to be in Latin, and I don't know that there were a lot of people figuring that out.
Right.
I think they want to keep it creepy.
Right. They don't want you getting too close to God.
Yeah, keep it mysterious. Make them work for it. See if they're interested. So that was it, praying at home.
Yeah, prayed at home.
But you said you did well in school, so you were able to kind of lock in.
Yeah, I was really good at school. I mean, my mom, for all her faults, she made sure that we were also good students and the importance of one day going to college or whatever.
But that's good.
That was itself another form of trauma, because my whole life I was like, I have to be good at school so that I can go to college and get as far away from my family as possible.
Yeah.
Like, that was the goal.
Sure.
But then once college time came around, I started talking about applying to out-of-state school. She's like, you're not leaving the state? Are you kidding?
dashed, your dreams dashed.
Dashed. I remember crying in the bathroom. I was so torn apart. And we didn't have money, so it's not like I could be like, well, I'm going anyway. I was so demoralized, I didn't even think to apply to any out-of-state schools. Like, maybe I'll get a scholarship, yeah. I can escape. I just didn't even think of doing that. So I applied to Rutgers, and they ended up giving me a full scholarship. So I was like, well, now I actually have to fucking go to this school, because now I don't have to pay for it. And that's
not a bad school.
Not a bad school. Actually, it was, well, very fateful, because that's the only reason I started doing stand-up.
But New Brunswick, how far is that from where you lived?
20-minute drive.
Oh.
I commuted my first 2 years.
And then what happened in the second 2 years?
I saved up enough money after working to get an apartment, an off-campus apartment.
In New Brunswick?
Yeah.
Wow.
Highland Park, technically, but yeah.
Yeah? Were you a Tom Sharpling fan?
Yeah, actually, I met him a couple times in the Starbucks of Island. I don't know why he was there, but...
Because he lived around there.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, that's where... That Sharpling's Jersey, man.
Yeah, that's where I met him, and I had already started doing stand-up.
Oh, wow.
He was so nice, yeah.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Very funny.
Very.
Yeah, well, that's good. So, fortuitous. So, how do you start doing stand-up?
The New Jersey Comedy Festival it was just a festival that would go to different colleges, and anybody could enter to try out, and then there'd be a final thing, and they would crown somebody, whatever.
Was it at Vinny's Club?
Well, Vinny, Stress Factory was part of the prize, where if you won, you would get to do...
I don't know if I've ever heard that said before. Vinny Brand was part of the prize.
Oh my God.
That is the first time that's ever been uttered.
Unfortunately, that wasn't on video. You nearly did a spit take.
Big prize to go to that place where they have a payphone on the stage. And he
will use it for 40 minutes before you go.
Of course.
Up.
And he'll run those videos of car crashes to warm the audience up. So, what year are you in college when you do that?
Junior year, thankfully, because. I won the contest, and I just obviously just became obsessed with stand-up. And so if it had been earlier than that, maybe I would have dropped out. But I only had a year to go, so I was like, I'll finish school. And there was like a little stand-up scene around college, so I could still just do it there.
Holy shit. So what were you studying?
English, philosophy, and Japanese.
Oh, so full liberal arts trip.
Yes.
And you did well.
Yeah.
How's your Japanese?
It was really good, and then I never practiced it, and a lot of it fled my brain. But I went to Japan recently, and it sort of started coming back, and so I want to get back into as good as I was back then.
Why Japanese?
I grew up loving Japanese video games and anime, and so I was just a nerd. And
that's the other component of you, is that in the midst of all this trauma, you're playing video games and looking at anime and doing nerd culture stuff.
I was just creating my own little world in my room where...
Yeah, you got a room eventually.
Eventually, yes, in high school, got a room. Oh, which...
Big step.
Sort of. The door, I mean, it was like...
Well, you talk about this on the special.
Yeah.
The no door business.
Didn't fucking close. Like, I finally got a room, but the door wouldn't close all the way, so I still didn't have my privacy, and my mom never knocked, obviously. Ugh.
My parents put us in the basement.
Oh, really?
In the first house, yeah, when I was like 10. There was like they just put a shag carpet in the basement and had a bathroom down there.
Was it furnished?
No, oh, yeah. It wasn't weird. They didn't chain the door. They just made a room and just put us down there. And there was two rooms upstairs that we could have had.
Why not?
But they just did this because the basement had been, you know, kind of carved out as a rec room for the people who lived there before. But yeah, we were in the basement.
That actually sounds nice.
It was big. It was good. We had a lot of room down there.
Yeah, like a clubhouse.
Sure, kind of. Yeah. Yeah, and there was a separate room that was, I don't know. I just remember at some point during my childhood, a cousin visited, was on the road, and it was just post-hippiness, and it was some cousin of my mother's, and they went down there, and they found this massive amount of drugs in the roof, like above one of the asbestos panels in the other room, what? In the basement, from the people that lived there before. It was crazy.
What kind of drugs?
Just weed and pills and booze, like whatever the kids were. They were not good kids.
That's so funny.
The kids that lived there before, they were not the great kids. But we had no idea. We were totally young. So you didn't have a door that worked, but you go to college. And what? So who are the comics that you're seeing? Are any of them around in college?
No, I mean, I guess Julian went to Rutgers, right? Or am I thinking?
Oh, did he? Julian
McCullough.
Did he?
I think so.
I haven't seen that guy in a while. Is he in New York?
I don't know. actually.
Yeah, I'd like to see that guy. That guy, he's been through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always really liked that guy.
Yeah. I hope I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure he went to Rutgers.
But, okay, so did you win the contest?
I won, and I got addicted to it.
Would you just write jokes? Who were you looking at? How'd you know what to do?
I don't know. I mean, at the time, honestly, I wasn't even that into stand-up. I would watch whatever's playing on Comedy Central.
Right.
I actually really loved Daniel Tosh. I watched his special.
Yeah.
Like, that's who I was trying to emulate when I was on stage, weirdly. Yeah. Like
jarring, shock-driven jokes.
I guess. I don't...
That's good. It's a good place to start. At least it puts you in the position to really take some risks, whether you know it or not, as to what the audience can take.
Right. I mean, I was channeling him. I had one friend, a philosophy colleague, and he's the one who actually, he's probably the reason I entered it, because like, I had a little crush on him, and he, at the time I thought he was so funny on stage, and then later I realized he was just doing Mike Birbiglia. And so, yeah, I entered. We like were writing with each other, and I won, and it was the first time I felt like I could communicate with people. Like, I was really a freak. I couldn't communicate with people. I had so much anxiety and trouble talking to people because of the way I grew up in my house. I didn't speak to anyone in my house. Like, I had no practice talking to people.
Huh.
Like, I just didn't know how to do it. I was, like, constantly being fired from jobs because I just couldn't communicate. I never spoke in meetings. Like, the fact that I performed doesn't make any sense. And I say it in the special, and it's true. Like, I would panic thinking about raising my hand in class. Like, I'm not supposed to talk. Okay,
but it totally makes sense. It's you learning how to talk.
Yeah.
Like, you finding a voice is exactly what you needed to do.
Exactly. And it changed my life. Like, stand-up really, really changed my life. Like, I don't know if I would have learned those skills if I hadn't.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know what I would be doing right now.
It's total self-ownership.
Right.
You know, and you might have innately known that. Like, you have complete control.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the difference between, I mean, like, when people are like, wait, you're afraid to talk in meetings, but you can talk in front of an audience, it's totally different. You're
totally
in total control on stage.
Right.
I'm not worried about what's going on in other people's heads.
Yeah, you can't be. I just assume they're not laughing because of me.
Exactly.
They could be thinking about the body they buried earlier. You don't fucking know.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole world out there in the
audience.
Sure,
man. Every person is a world. There's no fucking doubt.
It's so true.
And just the assumption, like, I always notice that about specials, too, and I always notice it about when I'm on stage. It's like, why is the camera stopping on the people not laughing?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you hear laughs. It's like, where are those people? And when I look at an audience, when I'm doing pretty well at a theater or something, and I look at people in the front row, I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Where are these laughs coming from?
You always zone in, right, on the people who aren't.
I do. Sometimes I'll zone in on one person to the point where they email me later and go, like, I was very uncomfortable.
Really?
It seemed like you were talking to me specifically for, like, at least a half hour of your show.
No way.
I don't know that I'm doing it, and I have to stop myself from doing it. Like, when you do a theater, you got to kind of look at everybody.
Yeah.
But, like, I just naturally kind of, like, end up in an area, and I'm talking, I'm not consciously talking to that person,
yeah,
but I'll catch myself realize that I'm looking at one person.
Right.
And then I'll look up, and I'll be like, all right, I'll talk to everybody.
Right.
I don't like looking out.
Yeah. I like looking out if I'm nervous, and it's like, I'm talking to nobody. There's literally nobody here.
That's good. So, okay, so the philosophy guy, he said he was a colleague. Was he just another student?
That's what I meant. I don't know why I said colleague. I was looking for a
colleague. Did you learn anything in philosophy? Was that a major?
Yeah. Actually, I didn't realize this, but Rutgers, top three schools in the world for philosophy. So they had all these amazing professors. I actually got a really good philosophy education. I wanted to go to grad school for philosophy or English. That was my plan. Or go to Japan and start and try to teach English.
Those are two amazing things. Huh. Philosophy, like, I always aspire to understand philosophy, but there's a language to it that I don't know, so you get lost pretty quick.
The problem is that philosophers were often terrible writers, and they were really trying to sound smart when they were writing, because I had this moment so frequently where I would read something and it's like so dense, and I'd be like, I think this is what they're trying to say, and the professor would be like, yeah, that's what they're saying. I'm like, why didn't they just say it simply?
Right.
Like, it's almost a way of, like, making sure people don't understand you. It's
like
isolating it from regular people, which I hated that part of it. And it's part of why I stopped. I was like, this is, like, it's for so few people in the world that it seems selfish to pursue something like this.
Well, it seems like the language was established to sort of continue dialogue with past philosophers. So, mm-hmm. like, whatever was established early on, you know, around being or not being and all this, that those concepts had to hold because so many of the philosophers were debating the past to kind of posit.
Right.
Right. I mean, I don't know. You're the philosopher.
I'm a stand-up philosopher.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of course, we all are.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But part of it also is like, I mean, some things are so hard to discuss, you have to go into this like language that's just.
Yeah, and some things are completely useless to discuss. I mean, it just feels like I'm not going to sit here and gripe about philosophy. But, you know, when people talk about philosophy in kind of a casual way, it's like we've obviously never read philosophy because it's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. That's as part of the reason why I decided not to go to grad school for it. I took a class called Philosophy of Metaphors. And I would just sit there.
Oh, my God. I just got tired.
I know. I would sit there and I'd be like, is this helping anyone in the world? Like,
right. Yeah.
Like, stand-up, honestly, it helps more people than, like, if you become a professional philosopher.
Yeah.
So it's like, it just felt like such a ridiculous thing and pretentious thing to pursue. But
it would certainly keep you locked in academia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which now sometimes I miss that bubble. I think of going back to the bubble of academia.
It's not easy in colleges now. You know, what's right and appropriate and what, you know what I mean? There's just a lot of stuff, not just diversity or gender and politics. I mean, you know, on campuses, the, you know, pro-Palestinian movement it's hard to talk about. But I think you said something recently about it.
The Middle East?
Yeah.
I've got lots of thoughts, lots of things.
Publicly?
Yeah.
And how's that going?
I mean, it made me go back to Twitter. Like, I'd stopped tweeting, and then I was like, you know, I think about it every day, everything going on there, and I feel like such shit every day, and I feel like a psychopath because it seems like every day I think about the compartmentalization of how we can just go. Did you see the Zone of Interest?
Yes.
I mean, it's like, that's about us. That's about us.
Totally.
And I don't know. I can't stop thinking about it. And the only way I can deal with it is by posting things. And even though that's useless as well, it's like maybe better than nothing. And so I post things just to sort of feel like I'm going less crazy.
And also it's tricky because, you know, whether you identify as a Muslim person or not, you are, right?
I don't know. I never know what to call myself because I'm not religious.
But I mean, like, as a Jew, you know, like, I'm certainly focused on fascism in this country.
Yeah.
And I talk about it all the fucking time. And I talk about anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. But this horrendous thing that's going on, this conflict, has shifted a certain amount of responsibility onto, you know, culturally American Jews because they are being framed as being implicated because of the nature of what Israel represents. And it's very difficult to have a public opinion without getting on either side, without getting torn apart.
Yeah.
And you just have to suck that up.
And it's disingenuous. I feel like there's like a small number of actors online and in the real world, and they make it their job to make sure no one can have a productive conversation
about moving towards a resolution.
Yeah.
And stopping the killing.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like, shut the fuck up. For a while, it's changing now, thank God, to be a more proactive conversation about ceasefire and a movement towards resolution of some kind. But at the beginning, it was like, you know, fuck you for even thinking that. Either you're with Israel or you're with pro-Palestinians. And then, you know, then there's, you know, framing as some are anti-Semitic, some are fascist. And then, you know, if you had just have a common sense, rational reaction to it, they didn't want to hear it.
Right.
Certainly as a Jew.
Right.
So it's very tricky.
It's unfortunate to weaponize racism as just a way of not having a conversation. It's like, and then you call out that tactic, but then there's like, nothing can stop them from just using that as a bludgeon.
And it's so tricky too. Like in terms of like global anti-Semitism, this is the other thing about being a Jew, is that there's definitely this normalization going on in terms of, you know, the worst parts of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. It's a conflict within me.
Right.
In terms of, you know, how to talk about it.
It's also a problem when everyone has different bits of information. 'Cause like
half of it not real.
Right. Like if you're not seeing like the footage of everything happening in Gaza and then you start speaking in very extreme terms, people think you're crazy. But it's just because they don't have access to the same information you do.
Yeah. And I think the bottom line is that active fascism that is brutalizing a minority is
bad.
Yeah.
No matter where it is.
Right. It's like, it's actually, people make it sound like what's happening right now is complicated. And it's not, it's as simple as should thousands of civilians be murdered? Like, that's not a complicated question.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
It's just annoying that people try to make it seem like it's more complicated than that.
I feel so powerless because even us talking about it, it's not like, you know, even if you talk about it publicly, it's not going to do anything.
Yeah. That's the hopelessness I feel every day. And that's why I post because it's like, well, I don't know, maybe this is something, but I feel like I'm losing my mind every day.
Do you get flack for it?
You know, it's funny. Like I stopped checking replies on things. It's a gift to not check replies.
Yeah.
But I did get a DM from, I don't even know the name of one comedian DM me after I did I do prank calls. I prank called, some senators about, Gaza.
Yeah.
And, someone DM me angry about that. They're like, your special was produced by Sam Morril, a Jew. And yet you say these, it's like, it must be people who, again, don't know what's going on. They just don't really know what's going on.
Or they're brainwashed by, you know, by Hebrew school. That the idea of the sovereignty and the necessity of Israel as a haven for Jews in the face of them being targeted runs deeper than God, and it runs deeper than almost anything else.
Right.
So to rewire that, which is a basic cultural Jewish education, I think it's difficult. Right. And so if you can't see past, you know, the thousands of Jews that were slaughtered to see the tens of thousands of Palestinians that are being slaughtered, they can't make that jump.
Right, right. I think also in general, at least in America, I really do think that, like, we've been normalized to think of the Middle East as a site of war.
And but it, like, has been. It,
exactly. But, like, I think in people's heads, they're like, oh, brown people over there are dying? Well, that's just what they do. Like, I really do think, I mean, I don't think they're actively thinking that, but it's subconscious there.
The fact is that a lot of this conflict has been going on for thousands of years, and even the smartest of people don't really have their brains wrapped around it.
Yeah. I mean, that is complex, for sure.
Yeah. We don't need to solve it here.
Yeah. Are you sure? I think we could solve it.
You do? Can we get the warring parties on the phone? Let me ask my therapist who's listening in. Could you get Netanyahu and the leader of Hamas on the phone? Because I think we've got this nailed. Shit. But what happened with that other thing? Like, okay, well, let's go back. So you win the contest. You get to play at the Stress Factory.
Yes.
How'd that go?
Well, I believed that I was going to be doing like 5 minutes. That was what it was sold as, I believe. But then Gracious Vinny thought it was okay for me to host instead as someone who has just started doing stand-up.
No?
No. I was like,
so you had to do 10 up front? And...
Yeah. And also warm up a crowd? I don't know how to do that. Like, I was so bad. I did the mistake even. I remember this, actually. Andy Pitts was featuring.
Yeah.
And I had to bring him up. And after my 10 minutes, I was like, okay, guys, now it's time to bring up an actually funny person. Like, I did that thing.
Yeah.
And so afterward, he graciously just explained to me why that's not good to do.
Vinny did?
No, Andy.
Oh,
Andy.
Okay.
Vinny, after I'd finished my set, I have all my jokes written on my hand.
Yeah.
He comes up to me. He's like, that was good. But here are the jokes I don't want you to do for the next set. And he lists all my jokes. And I'm like freaking out. And then he's like, I'm just fucking with you, which he does all the fucking time.
Yeah.
But that was his contribution.
Oddly, I think it was probably a good call to make you host.
Why? Because
it's a baptism in fire. And, like, you know, it's going to suck at some point. But to, like, host in that Jersey-ass room.
I guess.
I mean, it is sort of, it would have been nicer to have the cush guest spot, but.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe, I don't even think he was thinking that hard about it. Like, I'm going
to
teach.
No, he was thinking he didn't have to pay a host.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. It's worked out for Vinny. Then you go, how long before you move into New York?
That was like my home club for a while.
Really? So you'd go to the open mics there and shit?
Open mics every Wednesday, yeah.
That's good they still had them.
for sure. It was a fun little scene. And but I stayed, I guess, mostly in Jersey.
And you got to watch all the guys come in, too, right? All the comics come in from New York and stuff and do sets?
Yeah, the headliner sets. That's good. For sure. Yeah, it was great. Actually, Bonnie and Rich were often there at the mic on the mic days, too. So we got to watch them. That was
She's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, love them. They're the best.
Bonnie was an early inspo. She was actually she was a judge for that festival like the next year, not for mine.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, watching her was really inspiring. But for the first 3 years, I focused on Jersey, and then I moved to Jersey City, so I never actually moved to New York proper.
You live in Jersey City now?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Should we get a house or what?
Should you get a house?
Did you get a house?
Oh, no. No. I'm renting. I mean, at first it was like, this is the cheaper option, but now it's the most expensive city in the country on average, actually.
Your rent went up?
It did, but actually I have such a good deal, and that's why I can never leave. I have a really good deal on rent.
I was born in Jersey City.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep. I don't think the hospital's there anymore. My dad was born in Jersey City.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, so did you live in Jersey for a while?
Yeah, when I was a kid.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'm genetically Jersey all the way.
Wow, you're a Jersey
boy. Both my parents are from Jersey. Yeah.
You don't bring that up, do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. You know, when I talk to people from Jersey.
Okay.
But I don't, like, we moved out of Jersey, you know, when I was like 6 or something. Mm. And my dad was in the service and moved to Alaska for a couple of years into New Mexico. But I always had a relationship with Jersey because all my relatives were there. So I was there, you know, for, you know, fewer weeks, a couple times a year. My grandmother lived in Pompton Lakes. The other grandparents lived in Bayonne, then Asbury Park.
Well, those are at least nice parts of Jersey to visit. The beach,
I guess so. Bayonne. Yeah. It's okay.
Well, maybe not there, but Asbury Park.
They lived in this one, but it was before Asbury Park. It was like when it was not functioning anymore.
Okay.
I remember when I was real young, they had the little ride with the boats and you go in a circle. And my grandparents lived in that one apartment at the end of the boardwalk, which must have been Senior's apartment. It's still there. But it was like you'd walk on the boardwalk and it was just nothing going on.
Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't hopping.
That still sounds nice.
It was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like having memories of Jersey.
That's good.
So Jersey City, though.
One of us does. Yeah. Jersey City. Yeah. It's fine. And then, I spent all my time learning comedy in New York.
Who was your generation? Was it Sam?
No, that was above me. I'm trying to think of, like, who from my generation is even, like, I don't know. I feel like Sam's was the last one where, like, everyone could pop off doing stand-up quickly. And
oh, really?
Sort of, yeah. Like, I don't know. I mean, my probably best friend and in comedy is Dan Perlman.
Uh-huh. There's a bunch of you. Where'd you take that special? Union Hall? Where was it?
My special? Yeah. Lincoln Lodge in Chicago. Okay.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. That's Lincoln Lodge.
Yeah.
Huh.
I mean, I dressed it up.
I played there once, but I wouldn't remember it.
I only had performed there once before deciding to film it there. I really liked
and
it.
And Sam produced it?
Yeah.
And directed it or no?
No, James Webb directed it.
How did Sam get involved with producing?
I asked him to. I mean, Sam's been like the angel on my shoulders my entire career. Like,
yeah.
He's helped me with so much.
Yeah.
So I was like, I guess it's time to do a special.
Yeah.
And so I asked him. He was like, of course. And yeah.
What was his job in producing it? He paid for it or he
No,
just...
I paid for it. Just like sort of consulting. Like,
oh, good. Yeah.
He's
a good guy.
He's the best.
He's
helped me so much. I can't sing his praises enough. So.
Yeah. Came out good.
I don't know.
What? You're here to sell it.
Right.
It's great. It's your best stuff. This is everything you've learned and done. The best of it.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, like I said, you said it. I like nervous. I hate that. But whatever. It's fine. It's one thing. It's the first thing.
You think you look nervous?
I definitely do. You said it.
Well, I know, but I didn't want to be the only one saying it. I just want to make that clear. The jokes were good. You were funny. But, you know, I felt a little just as a comic. I don't know if anyone
Of course, no. I mean, the whole thing with me, like, I realized, like, halfway into my career that people thought I was doing a character on stage. This, like, nervous character. It's like, no, I'm just nervous.
Right.
And so, but I had to break out of that thanks to
the
pandemic.
Happening.
It's happening.
So the next special is going to be.
Next one. I'm gonna be
so confident. Swagger.
You know, just hold your hats.
So let's talk about this like this. I want to know how you got through that shit show with the tweet.
Yeah.
I'm sure if you're not tired of talking about it.
It wasn't a tweet. So I did, you're talking about the joke about the rapper.
Yeah.
Okay. It was for This Week at the Comedy Cellar, that show that was on for a little bit. I told a joke about, I mean, the theme, I cannot stress enough that I wrote this joke specifically for that show. The theme was R. Kelly. So I was like, I have this other joke about this other rapper.
Right.
And I just didn't know. I didn't know anything about that guy. I didn't know he had a cult following of millions of mentally unwell teenagers.
Yeah.
And Comedy Central didn't even tell me they were posting the joke. It was like at first a happy surprise. Like, oh, they posted the joke online. And then if I remember the trickle of replies at first that were like, that's fucked up. I was like, oh, that's funny. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And then it just very quickly spun out of control.
What was the joke?
So this guy, this rapper, he died on his way buying like a motorcycle. He was carrying like a bag full of cash to buy a car, whatever. Right. And these guys robbed him and shot him. And that's how he died.
Yeah.
And so the joke was just, that's very tragic, but it would be a really good Venmo commercial. It was a throwaway joke.
It's nothing. There's nothing wrong. It's not loaded. No, it's
nothing.
It's about Venmo.
It's to me, the humor was in how ridiculous it would be for Venmo, this huge corporation, to have such a violent commercial. That's what I thought was funny about it. But of course, it got spun into all kinds of things. I mean,
racial things.
Racial. I mean, anyone. It was such an interesting prism for if you had an agenda, that's how you approached this thing. I saw the free speechers come out defending me. Like the comedians were coming out defending me on behalf of comedians. And on the other side, it was like, this is a white woman making a joke about black deaths. Like, and I was like, first of all, I'm not white. And I posted that because I thought it might help. I was like, oh, maybe it'll help if they think I'm not white. So I was like, by the way, instead of calling me a white bitch, please call me an Arab bitch. And of course, that backfired immediately. Everyone was like, you terrorists, go back to where you came from.
Oh, no. So you brought in new people.
Yeah, I brought it. That backfired. And I was literally getting thousands every day.
Comedy Central did nothing.
Well, I spoke to them on the phone for like 2 weeks every day because, I mean, of course. So at the time, their whole strategy was like, we're not going to say anything because that'll make this all go away quickly.
Right.
And I was in such a mess where I was like, okay, that makes sense. I want it to go away. Whatever you say, whatever makes this go away.
Yeah.
And of course, I had other comics in my ear being like, they're just being cowards, like they should come out and defend you, they should say something. And I was like, I don't know, I just want it to go away. And they provided me with physical security. I had security at my house because they doxed me.
Oh my God.
These psychos posted what they thought was my address. It was my mom's address, the house I grew up in. And so they had security out there just making sure nothing happened.
Did anything happen?
No. But, like, when you're in that mental space, you don't know what's possible. The things I was reading, I'm like, oh, someone's obviously going to come try and kill me.
Sure,
like,
of course.
And so, nothing happened. But they were, I mean, I have so many absurd, like, I ended up staying with my mom just because she was freaking out.
Yeah.
And I would like, gather the courage to, like, go outside and, like, go to the mall. I was like, I'll go to the mall. And the security guard would come, like, shopping with me. It was just.
Wow.
So weird. And I would see
terrorized.
I was scared. I would see teens in the mall and I'd be like, oh my God, they're going to recognize me. They're going to try to fight me.
Yeah.
And then, of course, nothing happened. You realize the internet is this own like world.
But that is the effect that psychological terror takes.
Yeah.
That's the best hope that they had was to make your life terrifying.
Right.
So you either learn this lesson or never speak again.
Exactly.
I don't know if they know that as a group that's what they're doing, but that is the intention.
That's the effect.
Yeah, or to get you canceled, which I don't think that seems like a cancelable offense in terms of whatever that means. But that didn't sound like that's what they were trying to do. They just wanted you to, you know, be schooled.
It was a mixture of that. And like, it's funny, I was so naive at the time. Like, there was some messages coming from whenever there was somebody who messaged me and it seemed like I could actually communicate with them, I would DM them, be like, hey, do you want to talk about this? And of course, I never got a reply because that's not the point. They didn't want understanding. They were also using it for clout for their own brand of like, I mean, famous like rappers were making statements about it. It's like, you're really offended by this fucking little girl making a joke about this guy. No, you're doing it so you can seem high and mighty.
Oh, that's interesting. Right.
And like be a news story. Like, I mean, glom
on, pile on.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the most annoying thing was that, I mean, I don't think this is probably true, but I mean, the first person who posted about it, and it got a lot of traction was a comedian. And like that was the thing of like he was obviously doing it for clout to see it, like even though he had, had a show with Comedy Central, like, oh really, you're upset? Why don't you just DM your friend at Comedy Central instead of post making this post about it? Because it's obviously not about
And you knew this guy.
I didn't know him, but he was around. And then from there, like other outlets picked it up because he had a big following, I guess, a biggish following. But I think it would the same thing would happen whether he posted or not, because like it just it went crazy.
So what? How did it all? Did it just eventually fade?
It just faded. I mean, I was getting messages for a year. Like it was a year. I have screenshots of some of the messages still. It was like the craziest thing that's ever happened to me. And
but it didn't stop you from doing work or getting work.
I mean, it's funny because right before it happened, I had this like little deal with Airbnb. They were doing these like comedy experiences in New York where I come hang out with a comedian. And so they picked me and two other comics. And so I just finished filming the promo for that. And it was going to be a good chunk of money for me at the time. It was like $6,000. And then we had to cancel that because they were like, I don't think it's a good time for strangers to be able to come meet you. And so there was some, I did lose some money as a result, but, and I was scared. They were sending me messages like, we know you're going to be here. We'll kill you if you show up. So, for a while.
So you did lose a job. So that is sort of, you know, in the umbrella of cancellation in a way. I mean, it compromised your ability to work.
Yes. It was very frustrating. At the Cellar, I was going up under a pseudonym just in case.
Yeah. Like,
it was just,
there's a few women that do that at the Comedy Store just for individual stalkers.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
That's such a shame because then people can't show up and see them because they don't know.
Well, they can go do their bigger shows, but when they're just working out,
right.
You know, where, it's a fucked up world and it's easy to fuck someone's head up.
That's my fear, having a stalker. It's not happened yet. And I was afraid it only takes one mentally ill person to be like, okay, I'm going to go kill that person. Like,
or just make their life horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were so many.
And there's nothing you can do about it, really.
I mean, I had a little bit moments of fun where
I used to have a woman park in front of my house.
Really?
Yeah, for months.
And should she try to say anything? Or
she'd bring me presents and sit out there and watch, you know, things on her iPod and on her iPad and come to shows. It was like, you know, it just...
And then she just lost
eventually. Well, yeah. If you don't engage, you know, with that, with a one-on-one stalker situation, you know, eventually they do lose interest. Yeah.
Wow. And you never called the cops or anything?
I did on the one in front of my house, but they're like, you know, I'm like, I know you, there's nothing you can do, but maybe just, you know, ask her if she can go away.
Or at least, like, search her, make sure she doesn't have a gun or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, death threats are the worst. Yeah. But the cops really think, like, well, it's kind of part of it. And I don't know that it ever was part of it. And a lot of times, it really depends on your relationship with your own social media and with your own, you know, like, if you're on it all the time looking. Like, everybody who's really famous, more famous than us certainly, has lunatics.
Yeah.
So eventually you just have to not deal with it.
But they at least can afford like having security everywhere and like.
Right. That's true.
But that
that's
true. You hope. Life.
Yeah.
Also a bad way.
But everything's okay now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of the last time I got a message. It was definitely during the pandemic because whenever something happened in the news, they would change their insults. So it was like, I hope you get coronavirus.
Oh,
you
know? Right. Yeah. So that happened that long enough ago for it to have passed.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, pretty much over.
So what's going on, like, now? You're plugging the special, but are you just doing stand-up? You've written for a lot of things, too, right?
I write for The Daily Show now.
Now you do?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on over there?
Daddy's back. John Stewart is back.
Once a week?
Once a week on Mondays.
So you write for him?
Uh-huh, on Mondays.
Yeah.
And then the correspondent hosts the rest of the week. And
were you ever up to do the correspondent thing?
Well, I only started there recently. I started last...
Maybe with this newfound charisma.
Yeah.
This newfound zero fuckness. you're about to become a correspondent.
Well, since I'm newish, I don't think they allow the new writers to, like, try out or be considered.
How's the vibe over there?
I actually love it. Like, I really love being there. I I'd never thought I'd be happy in an office job.
Right.
But it filled this void that I had been feeling for years of like not feeling a sense of community.
Yeah.
Like, with stand-up, you know how it is. You have your scene and then yeah. everyone goes their different ways.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I don't feel that anymore. And so being there has really filled that void in a really positive way.
And you can go to work and it's focused.
And it's structure. Like, yeah. I really needed structure. I didn't know how badly I needed structure.
What do you mostly do over there? Monologue jokes or jokes? Or how's it work?
Well, we have, like, a morning meeting where we watch all the videos of the news that right. we're going to talk about that day. People casually throw out ideas and yeah. jokes. And then we go to our computers and we pitch. They tell us what they need specific jokes for. And then we all write them. Then they choose their favorites. And it goes into the script.
How's it feel to have – I wonder how it feels having John back there. Is it – like when he comes, I mean, you weren't there when he was there. Does it shift the environment?
I mean, it's exciting, but yeah. No, it's kind of this. The work is done the same way.
Yeah. Are you working on any other shows or any movies? Are you writing a thing?
I'm writing.
Got a big plan?
Thing. I'm out there pitching. Me and my friend, coworker Matt Koff, very funny comedian, are
yeah.
trying to work on a little tune.
A tune?
Cartoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've always wanted to. I've always wanted to do voice acting. I have had a couple, thanks to Rami, I did a role that was so much fun on his show that's coming out on Amazon at some point. I was voicing a suicidal lamb, which I feel like is just
yeah,
perfect
yeah.
for me. And so...
that could have been the name of your special.
Yeah. and so I want to do more of that. So, like, I would love to just have my own cartoon and do voices. That, to me, that's like, that'd be so... much fun.
Yeah, well, maybe it'll happen. Voiceover is fun. I did the Bad Guys movie, and it's great.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I did the Bad Guys movie, which was a pretty big DreamWorks movie. Now they're making another one. And DreamWorks is like 10 minutes from my house. So I'm like,
that's isn't it easy, cushy? Is
easy that... commute. Well, it's fun when you can get in the room with other people. A lot of times with voiceovers, you're isolated.
I was isolated, yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of fun when you can get it all going on.
That sounds fun.
It was fun. Because it's like Craig Robinson and Sam Rockwell and Awkwafina.
Oh, that's amazing.
Anthony Ramos. And yeah, it's funny.
That's so fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, it's good talking to you.
You too. Thank you.
I think we solved a lot of problems here, both personally and globally. I think we just did it. We didn't address climate change, but I don't know if we can really add to that conversation.
I have zero knowledge.
It's bad.
Oh, okay.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
That was good. I like her. Good comic. Smart. Good writer. All of it. Her special Dark Little Whispers is streaming on Prime Video. Go watch it. Hang out for a minute. People, the last Ask Mark Anything episode is now up for Full Marin subscribers, so go check it out to hear me answer questions like this. On your second CD, Tickets Still Available, there's a great hidden track where you name the feral cats Meanie, Monkey, Hissy, and Fuck. Aside from Monkey, did any of the other three cats stick around in your life for any reasonable amount of time? Did you guys ever really bond at all, or did those three remain feral? Well, let's see. I remember Hissy. I remember Meanie. I don't know if Fuck became Fonda, because La Fonda was one of that original litter. Monkey and La Fonda were with me for 16 years. Meanie split very quickly. A bodega across the street wanted a cat, and I brought him over there, and he was just too feral, and he disappeared into the world. Hissy, I actually found an owner. I don't know how that cat is doing, because they were all pretty feral, but a woman did take Hissy. It was a black and white long hair and a kind of a cool cat. But yeah, so I definitely bonded with Monkey and La Fonda. They were with me for their whole lives. To sign up for the Full Marin so you can get bonus episodes twice a week, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this show is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin sometimes. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. And don't forget, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a little guitar from the vault.
boomer lives.